you for joining us today. I think we've got a great webinar for you, Swing Bed Reimbursement in Critical Access Hospitals. And as you probably all know, the Office of the Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recently released a report entitled, Medicare Could Save Billions at Critical Access Hospitals if Swing Bed Services Were Reimbursed Using the Skilled Nursing Facility Prospective Payment System Rates. The report looked at swing bed usage and payment over a six-year period. They found that swing bed usage had increased significantly in that time, estimating that 90% of critical access hospitals had alternative facilities within 35 miles that could provide similar care, and that the Medicare program could have saved $4.1 billion over the 6 years if CAHs were reimbursed at the skilled nursing facility PPS rates instead of the current swing bed reimbursement structure. And since the release of that report, there have been many thoughts, opinions, perspectives offered on the study's methodology and what such a change would really mean for rural hospitals and patients. So we've got some great speakers today who will weigh in on those issues. And I'd especially like to thank the NRHA for helping us out in making their webinar platform available today so we could let more people join us, since we had such overwhelming interest in this webinar. Okay, and hopefully you are all seeing my slides. So we do hope that we'll have time to take your questions at the end of the webinar. If you do have questions for the presenters, we ask that you please submit them towards the end of the webinar using the questions section of the GoToWebinar control panel. And we've also provided a PDF copy of the presentation on the RAC website, and that's accessible through the URL that you see on your screen. Okay, so through that URL that you see on your screen, or you could go to www.raconline.org/webinars and click into today's presentation, and then you'd see where you can download those slides. We will be recording the webinar today, and we'll make that recording available on that same page on the RAC website. So I'd like to introduce our speakers. Our first speaker today will be Brock Slabach, who currently serves as the Senior Vice President of Member Services for the National Rural Health Association, or NRHA, which is a membership organization with over 21,000 members nationwide. Mr. Slabach has over 25 years of experience in the administration of rural hospitals. From 1987 to 2007, he was the administrator of the Field Memorial Community Hospital in Centerville, Mississippi. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree from Oklahoma Baptist University and his Master of Public Health in Health Administration from the University of Oklahoma. Our next speaker is Dr. Kristen Reiter, an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and a research fellow at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. She received her PhD in Health Services Organization and Policy with an emphasis in corporate finance in 2004 from the University of Michigan. She also holds a master's degree in applied economics from the University of Michigan. Prior to her PhD, she worked in public accounting at Deloitte & Touche LLP in Chicago, Illinois. Her primary research interest is understanding issues important to the financial and operational performance of rural hospitals. She is an investigator with the North Carolina Rural Health Research Center and a contractor with the North Carolina Office of Rural Health and Community Care. She also studies the financial implications of important policy or practice changes such as minimum nurse staffing requirements, patient-centered medical homes, and meaningful use and quality improvement. Finally, we will be hearing from Susan Starling, the CEO and President of Markham and Wallace Memorial Hospital in Irvine, Kentucky. For more than 20 years, Ms. Starling has been working in rural health, first as a nurse and for the past 12 years as a healthcare executive. Susan's commitment to rural health is fueled by her steadfast belief that rural Americans, particularly rural Kentuckians, deserve access to quality healthcare. Susan, who earned her master's degree in Community Rural Health Administration at Eastern Kentucky University, has worked diligently to transform the quality and delivery of healthcare in Appalachian Kentucky. Since 1991, she has served in senior management and is currently the CEO and president at Markham and Wallace Memorial Hospital, a critical access hospital in Irvine, Kentucky, and a member of Mercy Health. Susan presently serves on the board for the National Rural Health Association and chairs their hospital constituency group. She serves on the Kentucky Rural Health Association board, serves on the Technical Assistance Services Center Advisory Board at the for the National Rural Health Resource Center, and she chairs the Rural Health Issues Group for the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is also involved in many other state and local organizations. She's been recognized for her leadership in rural health with her most recent recognitions, the Shirley Monroe Leadership Award from the American Hospital Association, also Becker's 50 Rural Hospital CEOs to Know, Becker's 130 Women Hospital and Health System Leaders to Know, the Impact Award winner by Bluegrass Alliance for Women, and the Dan Martin Award by the Kentucky Rural Health Association. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brock for his presentation. Brock?
Well, thank you, Christine, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in this important discussion today. The issue of swing bed reimbursement has been looked at periodically over the past decade, actually, by MedPAC and others, including studies by the Rural Health Research Centers. And just a couple of weeks ago, the Office of Inspector General released their report on this topic. So before I provide a little historical background on swing beds, I'd like to take a moment to explain a little bit about the Office of Inspector General. Even though they are at the Department of Health and Human Services, they are an independent entity which is deciding on what they will study and what they will report on. It sometimes results in recommendations which are non-binding and certainly may have no impact down the road. So given all of the attention that this report is bound to generate around this subject, I appreciate Christine and the Rural Assistance Center in helping to organize this webinar today and to provide a forum for stakeholders to better understand what we know currently about the swing bed services from a historical, methodological, and a practical perspective. So I will address some of the historic issues. Kristen will handle some of the methodological issues, and then we'll close with Susan Starling on the practical perspective. I hope this provides an opportunity and a common understanding for everyone to talk objectively about swing bed services and reimbursement, which is an important discussion to have regardless, but particularly in this in light of this OIG report, we really want to make sure that everybody's up to speed and they understand the details about what we're talking about. So, let's start with a little background. The first bullet is the critical access hospitals were authorized by the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. The OIG, the Office of Inspector General report, offers the statutory background on the creation of critical access hospitals and even goes into some of the reasoning behind the designation. The CH program was intended to improve the financial viability of small rural hospitals that would be negatively affected by Medicare's inpatient prospective payment system. And then lastly, by reimbursing CAHs for Medicare services on the basis of costs, the law aimed to cease closures of these hospitals and, more importantly, maintain access to care in isolated areas. What I would like to offer in addition is further context on the why Congress created swing beds in the first place. Swing beds were part of a number of changes that Congress enacted following a period of closures of small rural hospitals that extended from the 1980s through the 1990s. The creation of the swing bed was done in recognition of the need for staffing and service delivery in small, low-volume hospitals. And I quote, to maximize flexibility of rural providers to deliver the care needed by its population on any particular day. Swing beds are acute beds that can be used for skilled nursing care. And this allows for more efficient use of limited resources, staff beds in other words, to provide a variety of services across a continuum. The ability to, and I use the term in quotation, swing a patient, is basically that you transition a patient from care between acute and skilled nursing services. This creates efficiencies for small rural hospitals that took into account then their small size to be able to move patients effectively using resources already available in the community. MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, testimony back in March of 2005 explained that a swing bed day or any type of patient day results in spreading the hospital's fixed costs over more inpatient days. Hence, the expenses allocated to Medicare acute days will be reduced when Medicare swing bed days are increased. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from Kristen Ryder at the North Carolina Rural Research Center on how that is the case through an explanation of cost-based accounting. So, Medicare beneficiaries are eligible for up to 100 days of skilled nursing services following a minimum 3-day acute inpatient hospitalization. And these services are provided in freestanding skilled nursing facilities, hospital-based skilled nursing facilities, and hospital swing beds. The entire report that the Office of Inspector General issued is available online, so I won't go into the detail of how the review was conducted. But in summary, the report makes one recommendation, and that is that CMS seek legislation to adjust CAH swing bed reimbursement rates to the lower SNF PPS rates using the resource utilization group process paid for similar services at alternative facilities. And as a proxy, that access would not be adversely affected by such payment policy. The report notes that of 100 CAHs randomly sampled, 90 had alternative facilities within 35 miles of with alternative skilled nursing care services available. In considering if equivalent post-acute services are provided at freestanding SNFs and hospital swing beds, the Office of Inspector General determined that they are the same, citing the language in federal code and defined similar SNF care to be available if sufficient bed capacity was available. The report also cited recent research stating patient characteristics are comparable regardless of post-acute discharge destination. However, because resource utilization group or RUG coding is not done for swing bed patients, it's not possible to compare the level of care provided to swing bed patients with care provided to SNF patients, or to confirm that equivalent care is truly available in freestanding SNF beds. Clearly, there would still be a significant number of alternative sites where a beneficiary currently served by a CAH swing bed could get skilled care services. But even then, Medicare would incur costs of transfer from hospital to the SNF that would not be incurred with swing bed utilization. The report did note in Appendix A, footnote 22, that's the OIG report, that the comparison of costs does not include the additional cost for transporting beneficiaries to an alternative facility, and therefore the estimated potential savings may in fact be overstated. The report estimated that Medicare could have saved $4.1 billion, that's with a B, over a 6-year period if payment for swing bed services at CAHs were made using the SNF prospective payment system rates. So while we see the way the report identified alternative sites for skilled nursing care as a proxy for access, and it obviously has shortcomings, there are even more shortcomings with the methodology used to estimate savings. One significant issue this slide points out is the potential impact on access. What if adjusting CAH swing bed reimbursement rates to the lower SNF PPS rates were to happen? How might we estimate how many CAHs would discontinue swing bed services as a result of losing cost-based reimbursement? Well, for a historical proxy, one might look at how many CAHs closed their long-term care nursing units due to the cost reporting ramifications and the financial impact of having nursing facility beds. What we can see from the information on the slide is that if a CAH discontinued swing bed services due to the recommended changes in payment policy suggested by the OIG, that would mean that for almost 20% of counties across the nation, there would be no post-acute skilled care available. The report estimated that Medicare could have saved $4.1 billion over a six-year period if payment for swing bed services at cause were made using SNF BPS rates. So while we see that the way the report defined the available beds as a proxy for access to equivalent care, a level of care has shortcomings, there are even more shortcomings with the methodology used to estimate savings. Cost report data shows that SNF utilization, a good proxy for both length of stay and additional cost to Medicare, is substantially higher in freestanding SNFs than in hospital-based SNFs or swing beds. So this chart illustrates how a comparison of only per diem and rates and not also freestanding SNF length of stay could easily lead to an overestimation of savings to the Medicare program. Once again, little is known about the acuity of CAH's swing bed patients relative to a SNF patient, but if the acuity of a patient in either a swing bed or a SNF exceeds the level of skilled care provided, that patient in the freestanding SNF will result in an additional ambulance transfer, an emergency department visit, and possibly even hospital readmission that the swing bed patient would not incur in order to receive the necessary level of care. In fact, there was a November 2013 OIG report stating that in fiscal year 2011, nursing homes, including skilled nursing, transferred one quarter of their Medicare residents to hospitals for inpatient readmissions, and Medicare spent $14.3 billion on these hospitalizations. It's also been pointed out the cost report ramifications of changing over if the swing bed was converted to a PPS environment. The cost reports would look far different from what they do today, with a significant increase in CAH acute care costs. Therefore, Medicare reimbursement for CAH acute care services would increase significantly, which would eat into the $4.1 billion in annual savings the OIG quotes in Appendix F of their report. It certainly wouldn't wipe out all of the $4.1 billion, but it wouldn't be surprising if it released at least $3 billion of the OIG's estimated savings. So this is another fallacy, I think, that would be introduced in terms of the methodology of the OIG report. In a pleasant surprise, CMS Administrator Marilyn Tavner, in responding to the report's release, suggested that indeed these savings are also inflated. With the additional costs of all of this, it may be difficult to quantify. The cost of these avoidable transfers, emergency department visits, and readmissions should not be excluded as part of any objective analysis of potential Medicare savings for simplification purposes. And now at this time, I'm pleased to welcome Kristen Ryder, and she is going to present to us now regarding the methodological issues regarding swing bed reimbursement. Kristen? I think you might be on mute, Kristen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, I was. I appreciate that. small technical snafu. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here. As Brock said, I'm here to talk about one aspect of the methodology used in the OIG report, and that is the cost accounting used to compute the per diem rate that was used to calculate the savings. And I'm going to do that through a study that we did in 2013 looking at the cost to Medicare of swing bed days provided in critical access hospitals. I'd like to start with a brief background. Some of this will be a little repeat to what Brock mentioned. In 2006, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission published a report to the Congress describing the effect on Medicare reimbursement of carving swing bed days back into the critical access hospital reimbursement formula after a period during which they had been carved out and paid separately. Essentially, what it looks like OIG is suggesting is again carving swing bed days out of the formula. As MedTech notes in the first passage highlighted in blue at the top of the slide, CMS currently divides hospitals' total inpatient routine costs by the sum of acute and post-acute days, including swing bed days, to arrive at an estimated routine cost per day, or a per diem rate. It is this per diem rate that is used to determine interim payments for acute and swing bed days to critical access hospitals. In the second passage you see highlighted in blue, MedPAC also notes that compared with the reimbursement method where swing bed days are carved out and paid separately, the new formula results in a reduction in payments for acute days because some of the fixed costs of providing routine inpatient care are transferred from acute care days to swing bed or post-acute days. Finally, in the third passage highlighted in blue, MedPAC notes that the result is that the true cost to Medicare for a swing bed day is actually not equal to the full per diem payment, but rather to something less. In other words, while hospitals might win on swing bed days, they actually are losing on acute days. And the net result is that rather than the full $1,000 per diem in 2006, each additional swing bed day was estimated to cost Medicare only about $400 to $500 once the fixed cost transfers are accounted for. My job today is to better explain what all of this means. This part of the webinar is very technical, and as you'll see in a moment, I'm going to use a very silly example to motivate it. But first, let's take a look at Medicare's current formula for determining reimbursement for routine inpatient care in critical access hospitals. The formula is shown here. On the left, you can see the calculation of the hospital per diem rate for routine inpatient care costs. The cost of nursing facility type swing bed days is carved out of total cost because it's paid by Medicaid. The remaining inpatient routine cost is then divided equally among acute days, skilled swing bed days, and observation days. On the right, you can see that the resulting per diem cost is multiplied by the number of acute and swing bed days covered by Medicare to arrive at total Medicare interim reimbursement. Next, I'll talk through my silly example to give you an idea of how the transfer of fixed costs works. I apologize to those of you who are already intimately familiar with this issue. Now might be a good time to check your email. So let's say for a moment that two families, a family of two and a family of four, decide to rent a fishing boat for a day and decide to divide the cost equally per person. The total cost to rent the boat is $840, regardless of the number of passengers. In other words, the cost of the boat is a fixed cost, or a cost that does not vary with volume. With six people, the cost per passenger is $840 divided by six, or $140 per person. At a rate of $140 per person, the cost to family one is $140 times two, or $280. The cost to family two is $140 times four, or $560. Now let's assume one member of family two decides to stay home. This is the person highlighted in gray that's off to the right of your screen. If you take the fourth member of family two out of the equation, you might think that the savings to family two would be $140, or the cost per person. But if you look, if that were the case, the two families together would only be paying $700 in total, the $420 plus $280. The fixed cost of the boat is still $840 and needs to be covered. As you can see here, with only five passengers, the new cost per passenger is $840 divided by five, or $168. So the new cost for family one is now 168 times two, or $336. The new cost for family two is now 168 times three, or $504. So what has happened? You can see that the removal of a passenger has resulted in the transfer of fixed costs from the person staying home back to the passengers that remain in the boat. The cost of family one goes up. Family two saves because they're now paying for one less person. However, the savings is only $56 and not the original per person rate of $140. So why did this happen? The fixed cost of the boat rental is now spread over fewer people. Now, instead of a boat rental, assume that $840 in fixed cost is the fixed portion of routine inpatient care in a hospital. These are the costs to keep the emergency department staffed, maintain the building, pay for core clinical and administrative salaries, and keep the lights on. These are the costs that don't change as patient volume increases or decreases. In this new example, family one is non-Medicare days. Family two is Medicare. The three people from family two that remain in the boat are the acute days. The person that stays home represents, because the cost of each acute care day goes up, as the, less the increase in the cost of acute days, less the new brings me back to our study. The aim of our study was to estimate the cost to Medicare for a critical access hospital swing bed day after accounting for the transfer of fixed costs from swing bed days back to acute. In order to estimate this cost, we recalculated Medicare reimbursement for routine inpatient care for each critical access hospital, assuming Medicare-covered swing bed days was equal to zero. In other words, we assumed Medicare swing bed days were carved out of the reimbursement formula. We first recalculated the per diem cost for routine inpatient care. We reduced total inpatient costs in the numerator by an estimate of the variable costs associated with each Medicare swing bed day. So for example, the cost of any supplies, laundry, meals, and other costs that are created by the fact that someone is in a swing bed. We reduced total inpatient days in the denominator by taking out the Medicare-covered swing bed days. Finally, we multiplied the new per diem cost by the number of Medicare-covered days after taking out the Medicare swing bed days. To get the implied Medicare expenditure on a swing bed day, we took the original Medicare reimbursement for routine inpatient care, including swing bed days, from the cost report and subtracted our recalculated reimbursement amount, assuming swing bed days were carved out. This produced an estimate of Medicare savings from the removal of swing bed days from the formula. We then divided this estimate of savings by the total number of Medicare swing bed days in 2009 to arrive at the implied Medicare expenditure on a marginal swing bed day. This essentially is an updated estimate of what MedPAC reported in 2006 to be about $400 to $500. So what did we find? In 2009, we estimated that the marginal or variable cost of a swing bed day, for example, supplies, laundry, and meals, was about $262. Accounting for fixed cost transfers back to acute care, the implied Medicare expenditure on the marginal swing bed day was about $581. This compares to an average routine inpatient per diem cost when swing bed days are included in the formula of $1,302. So based on our estimates, if swing bed days were removed from the formula, the cost of each acute inpatient day would increase by about $721 on average. Here we compare estimated Medicare savings from a change in payment methodology using something very close to the method that OIG used and data from our study. Using the per diem method of OIG, the savings to Medicare per swing bed day from reimbursing swing days at the PPS rate would be the difference between the average per diem cost and the average PPS rate. This results in savings of about $1,038 per day in 2009. Accounting for fixed cost transfers, however, we estimate the savings to Medicare at only about $317 per swing bed day. Based on our estimates in 2009, the OIG estimates of Medicare savings could be as much as three times too high. Of course, it's important to note that these are only estimates, and the actual savings to Medicare would depend on implementation of the new payment methodology and the amount of variation across hospitals in the implied Medicare expenditure per swing bed day. We did find some variation, and these estimates presented here are averages. Based on our study, we believe it's important to differentiate between the true marginal or variable cost of a swing bed day, the average reimbursement rate for inpatient days, which is the current per diem, and the marginal reimbursement rate, which is the reimbursement rate after accounting for changes in the per diem resulting from addition or exclusion of swing bed days from the per diem calculation. It's also important to recognize that any changes in payment policy would affect individual hospitals differently, depending on the relative mix of swing versus acute days in the hospital and Medicare's share of swing and acute days. Thank you for your attention. Here I've provided some citations to some of the studies done by the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program and a link to a YouTube video that explains fixed cost transfers. I think this was also provided in your invitation. I'd also like to let you know that based on our work, later today we will be releasing a critique of the methods of the OIG report. You can get it by going to our webpage, search for North Carolina Rural Health Research Program, and it's also linked from our Twitter account, at NC Rural. Now I'd like to turn it back over to Christine. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kristen. That was really interesting. Now, and I just want to remind everyone that you'll have a chance to enter your questions for Brock and Kristen, as well as for Susan, at the end of the presentations. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Susan.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. This is more of an operational issue presentation for us. It's shifting the focus. And I am the CEO at Markham Wallace Hospital. We're a critical access hospital located in central Kentucky. We're part of Mercy Health based out of Ohio. My presentation today is based on my experience with the swing bed program, as my goal is to share some of the issues that my hospital face. My focus is on the operations at my hospital. As you know, each critical access hospital is different, so we may share some of the same issues as other critical access hospitals, but there also may be some differences. Likewise, each long-term care and home health agency that I've we'll be talking about may be different, and what I describe and what happens in our community may be different and reflect differently from what is happening with other long-term care facilities and home health agencies. My goal is to demonstrate why the swing bed program is critical to our community and how this program is a necessary component in the continuum of care. As we look at the swing bed issues, the challenges that we face reflect why the cost of care may be higher in the critical access hospital and why the critical access hospital is growing. Nothing in my presentation reflects on the relationship that we have with the other providers in the long-term care and home health, as we all work together to make sure that the patient has access to the appropriate level of care, and it is definitely a team effort. So let's touch first on the discharge planning process. Not every patient that is admitted to our hospital is discharged in the swing bed program, but it is a necessary program for our rural community. We face many different barriers when trying to plan for the patient's discharge, and many times the swing bed program is our only option as we ensure that the patient gets the appropriate level of care. Discharge assessments begin at the time of patient's admission. Our nurses and care managers work with the patients and the families and physicians, and once the patient's needs are identified, we start the process, working with other agencies to ensure appropriate care is available at the time of discharge. As a critical access hospital, we have a 96-hour target to either transfer or discharge a patient, so we don't have much time to spare. Unfortunately, we have limitations, and at the time of discharge, the swing bed program may be our only appropriate option for our patient that's going to be discharged. Now, I would love to say that everything works well with the discharge planning process and that the process for care after hospitalization is very streamlined, but unfortunately, it does not necessarily work that way. Each patient and each agency has specific needs, and we need to work through their system, what patients are appropriate for them, and what skill level they can handle. So what options do we have? One is home health, but there are barriers to this, and the acceptance of the patient is dependent on multiple factors, such as traveling, distance, time, and terrain to the patient's residence. CEOs in frontier areas have communicated that distance is a huge challenge for them as they try to get home health services to accept their patients. Our issue in Kentucky is terrain, mountains, and curvy roads. Time of travel impacts their home health's financial status. The insurance is an issue. Private home health agencies are selective, and patients may be denied due to the type of insurance coverage they have. Most home health that we've been working with do not accept the Medicaid patient. Additionally, home health staff can't meet all of the patient needs. Home health has limited visits, and they're focused on education. The patient must have support at home. There must be a willing and able provider in the home to continue the care that the home health is providing. And then there is the acuity of the patients. The patients that we discharge have continued health care needs and have multiple problems. They are sick. The agency must feel comfortable that they can provide the level of care that the patient demands. Currently, home health services is available in our community, but it is very limited. Just in the past month, a longstanding home health agency discharged most of our Medicare patients that were in our county. We had over 80 of our patients were discharged in just one day. You know, I'm also afraid that this is not a one-time event, and our patients will be, continue to have limited access to home health services in our rural communities. Another option for our patients upon discharge is skilled nursing care. In my slides, I use long-term care for skilled nursing care, as we're considered them as the same for us. We do not have an intermediate care facility. Again, there are barriers to the long-term care option. Before a Medicare patient can be admitted to the swing bed or long-term care, a patient must have a 3-day qualifying hospital stay. At times, it's difficult to admit a patient in for a 3-day hospital stay, as they must meet the criteria for medical necessity. But once this is accomplished, challenges remain in getting long-term facilities to accept patients who are classified as high acuity. High acuity patients can be high utilizers of resources. The resources are either financial and or human resources. This is an issue since the skilled facilities are reimbursed in a different manner. The patients that are considered as high utilizers of resources are the patients that are challenged for us to get in transfer to a long-term care. Hence, they are the patients who are in our swing bed program. From a financial perspective, listed below are the examples of the challenges we face. If a patient requires transportation via EMS for follow-up care, this is an issue since the long-term care has to cover the cost for this service. And the homeless or the uninsured, long-term care agencies do not readily accept patients that can't pay. Fortunately, our hospital, we continue to care for the patients regardless of their ability to pay. In the past year, we have had several patients who could not pay. One patient who was homeless was in our swing bed program for over 100 days. Our community does not have a homeless shelter, and the patient did not have Medicare. There were no other options but our swing bed program for this patient. During the time he was in our facility, we applied for Medicare, and once he was approved for Medicare, he was then accepted into a long-term care facility. Human resource barriers relate to workforce issues. Staffing is limited at the long-term care, and patients' conditions who may consume the staff time are not the facility's first choice. The RN to patient ratio in the long-term care is higher than in our swing bed unit, and many times they are not able to handle the patients who require a significant amount of skilled care. Patients whose conditions demand attention to maintain safe patient environments or need a significant amount of one-on-one are also a challenge to place. These are the patients who utilize our swing bed program. Other barriers for placements of patients includes ones whose conditions required specialized care. The obese or bariatric patients and the respiratory patients require specialized care and specialized equipment. Bariatric or obese patients require the larger beds, sheets, mattresses, wheelchairs, special lifts. They need more staff to appropriately move the patient in an effort to avoid staff injuries and avoid worker comp issues. And then from a safety perspective in the older long-term care facilities, an obese patient in a bariatric bed can be a fire hazard as you can't get the larger bed through the door frames. The patient with respiratory needs present limitations. Most long-term care facilities do not have the equipment or the staff to provide the 24/7 respiratory care. These are the reasons why the swing bed program is so necessary in our rural communities. This slide covers why the swing beds are utilized in our hospital and why the swing bed program is so important. There has to be options for patients upon discharge in rural communities, and the swing bed is really a good solution. Utilizing the swing bed program can reduce the patient's length of stay. The swing bed staff is already familiar with the patient and their needs, and there is no learning curve involved when the care transitions. When transferring to an outside agency, the continuity of care is interrupted, and the learning curve for the new provider can prolong the patient's length of stay in the long-term care facility. And patients who are dying but don't require acute care hospitalization, do they need to be transferred into an unfamiliar environment during their last days? Our community and rural communities face the challenges that are not an issue in urban area. Urban hospitals have access to numerous options in the continuum care for patients upon discharge. As you can see, our options are limited. My father-in-law was recently discharged from a hospital in the Washington suburb area. The social worker provided me a list with over 25 facilities to choose from for his long-term placement. All facilities had access to public transportation. But unlike in our community, we have an option of one or two facilities that are close. And since we do not have public transportation, no buses or taxis in our community, patients want to be close to home. The lack of availability of service in the community dictates that our swing bed unit needs to be able to care for patients with special needs. Our mission is to meet the needs of the patients regardless of their issues and their ability to pay. Acuting staffing needs are not an issue. We have the staff and we have the resources to be there when the patients and the families need us most. Now that was some of the an overview of some of the challenges that we face, hence why the swing bed program is so important to our rural communities. We need this program to help address the healthcare needs of our community that we serve. And it's just not about the cost and it's not just about the mileage. It's about quality, access, and patient outcomes. And at the end of the day, the swing bed program is a viable solution for our rural communities. Can we stop the attack on rural? Well, all the issues that we face at the critical access hospitals and all the hoops that we have to jump through. The inpatient must stay at least 48 hours, but no longer than 96 hours, and now we have to defend our swing bed program. Can we please just focus on what's important and let's do the right thing? Let's focus on the patient, and that's what we do in rural, and that's what makes rural special. Brock?
Well, thank you, Susie, and that was a tremendous overview of the importance of the community-based services that remain vital in our rural communities. So I'm going to turn it back over to you, Christine, and we'll begin the Q&A and any more comments.
All right. Thanks, Brock. And thanks to all of our presenters today. That was really interesting and valuable information. Let's see. It looks like I'm having a little trouble here with the Q&A, Brock. Are you seeing any questions?
Yeah, there's a couple that I'm noting. Let's see. Susie, there was one directed to you. How many beds and how much annual revenue, and that's in gross, for your hospital there in Kentucky?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't have those numbers. We're 25-bed critical access hospital, and I don't have my gross revenue in here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
You see the next question, Christine?
Let's see. There are some questions about the slides, and those are available on the RAC website. And we will also make sure that they get sent out to everyone along with the recording. Here's a question for you, Susan. Do you have pushback from nurses who do not want to take care of a nursing home patient?
No, we don't have any pushback at all. In fact, I mean, they're all patients we're caring for, so I mean, we don't look at them as the difference between nursing home patients or inpatients, et cetera. They're just our patients.
All right. And then can a PA or NP admit to a swing bed?
I think each state is regulated differently, but we do have nurse practitioners who work with our hospitalists for admissions to the swing bed unit.
Okay. And it says, another one, Susan, are you saying that you admit patients to swing beds that are dying, and how do you qualify them?
Basically, they've been in our inpatient area, and we go with the guidelines. I mean, there's certain guidelines we follow. I know that you're allowed a certain amount of time for the patient to be observed, and then there's depending on what are the things that you're doing for it. So we follow interqual criteria. We have not had any problems, but yes, we do keep a patient who is, death is imminent in our swing bed area.
Okay. Brock, it looks like there are several questions related to who should they contact if they want to voice their concerns over this issue. And another one, how do we feel regarding the legislation and whether or not we can win this one?
Thank you, Christine. Yeah, that's a very important question. I was going to make that comment in closing that first I would suggest that everyone contact their representative and senators and express their dismay over this report and seek their commitment to not make any effort to advance this proposal from the OIG into legislation. So that would be the first and foremost thing that you can do. And talk about the things that we visited on here on this webinar. And Susie did a great job at the end summarizing what it means for patients. And if you would incorporate those kinds of vignettes into your stories to the to your legislators, that would be, I think, a very, very important issue. Also, you can follow NRHA's website. We post information frequently on things that are vital to you all as rural providers in CAHs running swing beds. And you can check out our website. Also, we have a blog. You can connect to our blog through the top line of our website. And then through our member-only site, which is NRHA Connect, I will typically blog and provide resources to members in that format as well. So those are some of the ways in which we can continue to make the communication known for you to be able to act when necessary. Any other questions, Christine?
Yes, it helps if I'm not on mute. Can you explain the main differences between the CAH swing bed program or swing bed and non-CAH swing beds?
I'll go ahead and field that. A swing bed, and Kristen, you might want to jump in on anything that I've gotten incorrect. A swing bed is part of the inpatient complement of services within a critical access hospital. And actually, PPS hospitals less than 50 beds are eligible for cost-based reimbursement as well in a swing bed format. So it's not just exclusive to critical access hospitals. But these are programs and services that allow for the utilization or the efficient utilization of resources that can be made available in a rural community that otherwise would not be present. And I think that's what the legislation was originally intended for in 1997 when this program was created. Kristen, any further insights on that?
No, I think that covers it.
Thank you.
Okay. Follow up on your statements about following up with legislators, Brock. Which House or Senate committees would be most likely to forge any such legislation?
If it was in the Senate, it would go to Medicare legislation, which would generate typically in the Senate Finance Committee. And on the House side, it could probably come through any number of different committees in that particular venue, House Ways and Means, Energy and Commerce. But I think the critical thing is to make sure that your own individual senators and representative are well aware of your view on this particular topic to make sure that this doesn't see the light of day. We were very successful, I will say, historically, just in follow-up on that. When the OIG released its report on the necessary provider provisions and recommended that we begin to end the necessary provider program for critical access hospitals, the blowback to Congress was really high, and congressmen were denouncing that report and publicly stating that they weren't going to have anything, they weren't going to be participating in any legislation to address that issue. I think we can generate the same kind of interest after this, and I think that in the first case it was very effective, and I think that we can be very effective in this case as well.
Great, thank you. We have a comment here from Kara. She says they recently had an issue due to flu and pneumonia where local nursing homes were full and patients would have to go over 50 miles from home if they didn't have the swing bed program in the critical access hospital there. So I think that's a nice example of why it's so important. And let's see. Brock, will NRHA have some talking points for people who are interested?
Yes, we have those available on the blog that I wrote a week or two ago that's available off our website. If you go to NRHA Connect, and you can get access to that. The talking points are found in terms of resources that are available, resources available to you through that venue.
All right. A comment here from Tim also regarding the PPS hospitals and the swing bed program there. It says, Brock, PPS hospitals do not get any cost-based reimbursement for swing beds regardless of bed size. We're paid under RUGs just like skilled nursing facilities. So thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, that's a historic legacy of something that crept into my faulty memory there, and, and that's no longer true, so that's correct.
We do have a question on Medicaid and whether if a patient has Medicaid, are they eligible to stay in the cot for swing bed? The question says, my understanding is they need to go to the nearest nursing facility or SNF for SNF stay. Our nearest nursing facility stated that with Medicaid being the only payer and not having long-term care Medicaid, he was not eligible for his for the facility, and the patient didn't have SSI either. So just wondering about the eligibility there. Do any of you know?
Our patients, Medicaid pays for patients in our swing bed. In our state, we're cost-based reimbursed for Medicaid, except now we've transitioned to a Medicaid managed care companies, and we are seeing that the Medicaid and Medicaid managed care companies are denying patients to swing bed status.
Okay. A couple other comments here. One is that most of our patients on swing bed are post-op orthopedic patients. They do not want to rehab in another city that's an hour or more away from home. So that's why their swing bed program is so important. Another commenter says that all of our skilled nursing facilities refuse to take any patients requiring IVs and other more intense services. And it looks like some of the Medicaid varies by state. Other people are commenting. Um, Okay, here's another question. I've been asked in regard to distance needed between a swing bed hospital, not a CAH, and a long-term care facility. Is this regulated? Anybody want to take that one?
This is Kristen. I don't know of any distance requirements.
There's none that I know of either, and if there were any, it would be state dictated, particularly if they have certificate of need requirements, which are waning now in terms of the number of those. So I would agree.
All right. Well, I think we have covered all the questions that have been asked so far. Okay, here's one more that just came in. Please clarify 3-day inpatient stay before Medicare SNF coverage. Does a patient need to be in an acute bed for 3 days before both swing and SNF?
It's my understanding, yes, but the 3-day qualifying hospital stay as an inpatient, but if a patient within a 30-day period for Medicare. So if a patient was in a hospital stay and went home and they found out that that was not an option for them and they needed to want to come into our swing bed, as long as it was in a 30-day period from their 3-day qualifying hospital stay, then we would be able to take the patient into it and Medicare would cover it.
Yes, those are the federal regulations.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. I think since we are awfully close to the 1 hour mark, that we'll wrap up. Thanks again to our presenters today and for everyone who participated. We really appreciate you being with us today. This is an important issue, and we appreciate your interest. Once again, the slides used in today's webinar are currently available at www.raconline.org/webinars, and then look for today's webinar, and the slides are available on that page. In addition, a recording and a transcript of today's webinar will be made available on that same page in the next few days. And so that will give you an opportunity to either listen again or share this presentation with your colleagues. So thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you, Christine. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.